Like myself, they stay in the shade as much as possible. To conserve bodily moisture and energy, the rodents remain in their burrows during the day. Scorpions and spiders go underground for the duration. Deer, antelope, bighorn sheep, bobcats, foxes, and coyotes all shade up beneath rock ledges, oak brush, pinon, and juniper trees till the sun goes down. Even the red ants keep to the inside of their evil nests at noon, though they will come spilling out eager to fight if riled with a stick. I've tried it, naturally. Flowers curl up, leaves fold inward. Everything shrinks, contracts, shrivels. Somewhere a desiccated limb on an ancient dying cottonwood tree splits off from the trunk, and the rending fibers make a sound like the shriek of a woman. The birds are muted, inactive. Now and then I can hear the faraway call of a mourning dove, a call that always sounds far away. A few gray desert sparrows fly from one tree to the next, stop there, do not reappear. The ravens and magpies stay in the shade, the former up on the rim rock, the latter in the trees. The owls, of course, and the nighthawks keep to holes and crevices during the day. Insect life, sparse to begin with on the open desert, diminishes to near total invisibility and inaudibility during the heat of the day, although at times, during the very hottest and stillest hour, you may hear the eerie ticking noise of a sun-demented cricket or locust, a small sad music that seems to have, like a Bach partita, a touch of something ageless, out of time, eternal in its primeval vibrations. In this static period, even the domestic livestock, horses, sheep, goats, cattle, have sense enough to take it easy, relaxing in the shade. Of all the featherless beasts, only man, chained by his self-imposed slavery to the clock, denies the elemental fire and proceeds as best he can about his business, suffering quietly, martyr to his madness. Much to learn. Among the wild things, only the hawks, vultures, and eagles seem to remain fully active during the hottest days and hottest hours of the desert. I have seen them circling and soaring far in the sky at high noon, dark wings against the blue, above the heat. What are they doing up there in the middle of the sky at the apex of the day? I watch them for hour after hour with the naked eye and with binoculars, and never see either hawk or eagle stoop and strike at such a time. And no wonder, for there's precious little fresh meat abroad. Nor does the buzzard descend for lunch or make any effort of any kind. The hawks appear most frequently and most briefly, gliding overhead on some invisible stream in the air. The golden eagle does not come into sight often, but stays longer than the hawk, floating toward the horizon in overlapping circles until out of sight. The vulture or buzzard, master of soaring flight, is most common and most often seen. He stays aloft for hours at a time without ever stirring his long, black, white-trimmed wings, recognizable at a great distance by their dihedral inclination. Never in a hurry to get anywhere or do anything, an indolent and contemplative bird, he hovers on a thermal, rocking slightly, rising slowly, slips off, sails forward and upward without lifting a feather, primaries extended like fingers at his wingtips. He soars around and around in expanding spirals, lingering at 1,000 feet above the landscape, bleak eyes missing nothing that moves below. Or maybe, who can be sure, he is fast asleep up there, dreaming of a previous incarnation when wings were only a dream. Still without a stroke, the vulture rises higher, higher, in ever wider circles until nothing can be seen of this gaunt, arrogant, repellent bird, but the cold dark V-sign of his wings against the blue dome of heaven. Around noon, the heat waves begin flowing upward from the expanses of sand and bare rock. They shimmer like transparent, filmy veils between my sanctuary in the shade and all the sun-dazzled world beyond. Objects and forms viewed through this tremulous flow appear somewhat displaced or distorted, as a stick seems bent when half immersed in water. The great balanced rock floats a few inches above its pedestal, supported by a layer of superheated air. The buttes, pinnacles, and fins in the windows area bend and undulate beyond the middle ground like a painted backdrop stirred by a draft of air. The peaks of the Sierra La Salle, Mount Nass, Mount Temaski, Mount Peel, Mount Tuckanickavots, and the others, seem to melt into one another, merging like cloud forms, so that the profile of one mountain cannot be distinguished from that of another closer or farther away. In the foreground, the dwarf trees of pinon pine and juniper waver like algae under water, without, however, losing any of their sharpness of detail. There is, in fact, no illusion of the sort called mirage, only the faint deception of motion, where nothing is actually moving but the overheated air. You are not likely to see a genuine mirage on the high desert of Canyon and Mesa country. For that spectacle, we must go west or southwest, into the basin and range provinces of Arizona, Nevada, Southern California, and Sonora. There the dry lake beds between the parallel mountain ranges fill with planes of hot air which reflect sky and mountains in mirror fashion, creating the illusory lakes of blue water, the inverted mountains, the strange vision of men and animals walking through or upon water. Palestinian miracles. Dehydration. The desert air sucks moisture from every pore. I take a drink from the canvas water bag dangling near my head, the water cooled by evaporation. Noontime here is like a drug. The light is psychedelic, the dry electric air narcotic. To me, the desert is stimulating, exciting, exacting. I feel no temptation to sleep or to relax into occult dreams, but rather an opposite effect which sharpens and heightens vision, touch, hearing, taste, and smell. Each stone, each plant, each grain of sand exists in and for itself, with a clarity that is undimmed by any suggestion of a different realm. Claritas, integritas, veritas. Only the sunlight holds things together. Noon is the crucial hour. The desert reveals itself nakedly and cruelly, with no meaning but its own existence. My lone juniper stands half alive, half dead, the silvery, wind-rubbed claw of wood projected stiffly at the sun. A single cloud floats in the sky to the northeast, motionless, a magical coalescence of vapor where a few minutes before there was nothing visible but the hot, deep, black-grained blueness of infinity. Life has come to a standstill, at least for the hour. In this forgotten place, the tree and I wait on the shore of time, temporarily free from the force of motion and process and the surge toward, what, something called the future? I am free, I am compelled to contemplate the world which underlies life, struggle, thought, ideas, the human labyrinth of hope and despair. Through half-closed eyes, for the light would otherwise be overpowering, I consider the tree, the lonely cloud, the sandstone bedrock of this part of the world, and pray, in my fashion, for a vision of truth. I listen for signals from the sun, but that distant music is too high and pure for the human ear. I gaze at the tree and receive no response. I scrape my bare feet against the sand and rock the table, and am comforted by their solidity and resistance. I look at the cloud. The Moon-Eyed Horse. When we reached Salt Creek, we stopped to water the horses. I needed a drink myself, but the water here would make a man sick. We'd find good water farther up the canyon at Cigarette Spring. While Mackey indulged himself in a smoke, I looked at the scenery, staring out from under the shelter of my hat brim. The glare was hard on the eyes, and for relief I looked down, past the mane and ears of my drinking horse, to something near at hand. There was the clear, shallow stream, the green wire grass standing stiff as bristles out of the alkali-encrusted mud, the usual deer flies and gnats swarming above the cattle tracks and dung. I noticed something I thought a little odd. Cutting directly across the cattle paths were the hoof prints of an unshod horse. They led straight to the water and back again, following a vague little trail that led into the nearest side canyon, winding around black brush and cactus, shortcutting the meanders of the wash. I studied the evidence for a while, trying to figure everything out for myself before mentioning it to Mackie, who knew this country far better than I ever would. He was a local man, a Moabite, temporarily filling in for Viviano Jaquez, who'd had another quarrel with old Roy Scobie and disappeared for a few days. "There's a horse living up that canyon," I announced. "A wild horse. And a big one. Feet like frying pans." Slowly, Mackie turned his head and looked where I pointed. "Wrong again," he said, after a moment's consideration. "What do you mean, wrong again? If it's not a horse, it must be a unicorn. Or a centaur. Look at those tracks. Unshod. And from the wear and tear on that trail, it's been living out here for a long time. Who runs horses out here?" We were about 20 miles from the nearest ranch. "Nobody," Mackie agreed. "You agree it's a horse?" "Of course it's a horse." "Of course it's a horse. Well, thank you very much. And no shoes, living out here in the middle of nothing, it must be a wild horse." "Sorry," Mackie said. "Wrong again." "Then what the hell is it?" "Old Moon-Eye is what you might call an independent horse. He don't belong to anybody. But he ain't wild. He's a gelding, and he's got Roy Scobie's brand on his hide." I stared up the side canyon to where the tracks went out of sight around the first bend. "And this Moon-Eye lives up there all by himself?" "That's right. He's been up in that canyon for 10 years. "Have you seen him?"
"No.
Moon-Eye is very shy. But I heard about him." Our mounts had raised their heads from the water, and, shifting restlessly under our weight, they seemed anxious to move on. Mackie turned his horse up the main trail, along the stream, and I followed, thinking. "I want that horse," I said.
"What for?"
"I don't know."
"You can have him."
We rode steadily up the canyon, now and then splashing through the water, passing under the high red walls, the hanging gardens of poison ivy and panic grass, the flowing sky. Where the trail widened, I jogged my horse beside Mackie's, and after a while, with a little prodding, extracted from him the story of the independent horse. First of all, Moon-Eye had suffered. He had problems. His name derived from an inflamed condition of one of his eyes called moon blindness, which affected him periodically and inflamed his temper. The gelding operation had not improved his disposition. On top of that, he'd been dude-spoiled, for old Roy had used him for many years, since he made a poor cow horse, in his string of horses for hire. The horse Moon-Eye seemed safe and well-behaved, but his actual feelings were revealed one day on a sightseeing tour through the Arches, when all his angers came to a boil and he bucked off a middle-aged lady from Salt Lake City. Viviano Jaquez, leading the ride, lost his temper and gave the horse a savage beating. Moon-Eye broke away and ran off into the canyons with a good saddle on his back. He didn't come back that night. Didn't come back the next day. Never came back at all. For 2 weeks, Viviano and Roy tracked that horse, not because they wanted the horse, but because Roy wanted his saddle back. When they found the saddle, caught on the stub of a limb, the cinch straps broken, they gave up the search for the horse. The bridle they never recovered. Later on, a few boys from town came out to try to catch the horse and almost got him boxed up in Salt Creek Canyon. But he got away, clattering over the slick rock wall at an angle of 45 degrees, and was seldom seen afterward. After that, he stayed out of Box Canyons and came down to the creek only when he needed a drink. That was the story of Moon-Eye. We came at noon to the spring, dismounted, unsaddled the horses, and let them graze on the tough brown grass near the cottonwoods. We dipped our cupped hands in the water and drank, leaned back against a log in the cool of the shade, and ate some lunch. Mackie lit a cigarette. I stared out past the horses at the sweet green of the willows and cottonwoods under the hot red canyon wall. Far above, a strip of blue sky, cloudless. In the silence I heard quite clearly the buzzing of individual flies down by the creek, the shake and whisper of the dry cottonwood leaves, the bright tinkling song of a canyon wren. The horses shuffled slowly through the dead leaves, ripping up the grass with their powerful, hungry jaws, a solid and pleasing sound. The canyon filled with heat and stillness. "Look, Mackie," I said, "what do you suppose that horse does up in there?"
"What horse?"
"Moon Eye. You say he's been up that dry canyon by himself for 10 years.
Right.
What does he do up in there?"
"That is a ridiculous question."
"All right, it's a ridiculous question. Try and answer it."
"How the hell should I know? Who cares? What difference does it make?"
"Answer the question."
"He eats. He sleeps. He walks down to the creek once a day for a drink. He turns around and walks back. He eats again. He sleeps again."
"The horse is a gregarious beast," I said. "A herd animal, like the cow, like the human. It's not natural for a horse to live alone."
"Moon Eye is not a natural horse."
"He's supernatural?"
"He's crazy. How should I know? Go ask the horse."
"Okay, I'll do that."
"Only not today," Mackie said. "Let's get on up and out of here."
We'd laid around long enough. Mackie threw away the butt of his cigarette. I tanked up on more water. We mounted again, rode on to the head of the canyon where a 40-foot overhang barred the way, turned and rode back the way we'd come, clearing out the cattle from the brush and tamarisk thickets, driving them before us in a growing herd as we proceeded. By the time we reached the mouth of the canyon, we had a troop of 20 head plodding before us through the dust and heat, half of them little white-faced calves who'd never seen a man or a horse before. We drove them into the catch pen and shut them up. Tomorrow the calves would be branded, castrated, earmarked, dehorned, inoculated against blackleg, and the whole herd trucked to the mountains for the summer. But that would be a job for Mackie and Roy, not for me. For me, tomorrow meant a return to sentry duty at the entrance of the monument, the juniper guard, and the cloud formation survey. As we loaded the horses into the truck for the return to the ranch, I asked Mackie how he liked this kind of work. He looked at me. His shirt and the rag around his neck were dark with sweat, his face coated with dust. There was a stripe of dried blood across his cheek where a willow branch had struck him when he plunged through the brush after some ignorant cow.
"Look at yourself," he said.
I looked. I was in the same condition.
"I do this only for fun," I explained. "If I did it for pay, I might not like it. Anyway, you haven't answered my question. How do you like this kind of work?"
"I'd rather be rich."
"What would you do if you were rich?"
He grinned through the dust.
"Buy some cows of my own."
I hadn't forgotten the moon-eyed horse. A month later, I was back at the spot by Salt Creek where I'd first seen the tracks, this time alone, though again on horseback. We were deep into the desert summer now, and the stream had shrunk to a dribble of slimy water oozing along between sun-baked flats of mud. As before, I let my pony drink what he wanted from the stream while I pondered the view from beneath the meager shelter of my hat. The alkali, white as lime, dazzled the eyes. The wiregrass looked sere and shriveled, and even the hosts of flies and gnats had disappeared, hiding from the sun. There was no sound but the noise of my drinking mount, no sight anywhere of animate life. In the still air, the pinkish plumes of the tamarisk, light and delicate as lace, drooped from the tips of their branches without a tremor. Nothing moved, nothing stirred, except the shimmer of heat waves rising before the Red Canyon walls. I could hardly have picked a more hostile day for a venture into the canyons.
If anyone had asked, I'd have said that not even a mad horse would endure a summer in such a place. Yet there were the tracks as before, coming down the pathway out of the side canyon and leading back again. Moon Eye was still around. Or at any rate his tracks were still here, fresh prints in the dust that looked as if they might have been made only minutes before my arrival. Out of the heat and stillness came an inaudible whisper, a sort of telepathic intimation that perhaps the horse did not exist at all, only his tracks. "You ought to get out of this heat," I told myself, taking a drink from the canteen. My saddle horse raised his dripping muzzle from the water and waited. He turned his head to look at me with one drowsy eye. Strings of algae hung from the corner of his mouth. "No," I said, "we're not going home yet." I prodded the animal with my heels. Slowly we moved up into the side canyon following the narrow trail. As we advanced, I reviewed my strategy. Since Moon Eye had learned to fear and distrust men on horseback, I would approach him on foot. I would carry nothing in my hands but a hackamore and a short lead rope. Better yet, I would hide these inside my shirt and go up to Moon Eye with empty hands. Others had attempted the violent method of pursuit and capture and had failed. I was going to use nothing but sympathy and understanding, in direct violation of common sense and all precedent, to bring Moon Eye home again. I rounded the first bend in the canyon and stopped. Ahead was the typical scene of dry wash, salt bush, and prickly pear, tailless slopes at the foot of vertical canyon walls. No hint of animal life. Nothing but the silence, the stark suspension of all sound. I rode on. I was sure that Moon Eye would not go far from water in this weather. At the next turn in the canyon, a mile farther, I found a pile of fresh droppings on the path. I slid from the saddle and led my pony to the east side of the nearest boulder and tied him. Late in the afternoon, he'd get a little shade. It was the best I could do for him. Nothing else was available. I pulled off the saddle and sat down on the ground to open a can of tomatoes. 1 o'clock by the sun and not a cloud in the sky. Hot. I squatted under the belly of the horse and ate my lunch. When I was finished, I got up, reluctantly, stuffed hackamore and rope inside my shirt, hung the canteen over my shoulder, and started off. The pony watched me go, head hanging, the familiar look of dull misery in his eyes. "I know how you feel," I thought, "but by God, you're just going to have to stand there and suffer. If I can take it, you can." The midday heat figured in my plan. I believed that in such heat the moon-eyed outlaw would be docile as a plow horse, amenable to reason. I thought I could amble close, slip the hackamore over his head, and lead him home like a pet dog on a leash. A mile farther, and I had to take refuge beneath a slight overhang in the canyon wall. I took off my hat to let the evaporation of my sweaty brow cool my brains, tilted the canteen to my mouth. Already I was having visions of iced drinks, waterfalls, shade trees, clear, deep emerald pools. Forward. I shuffled through the sand, over the rocks, around the prickly pear and the spiny hedgehog cactus. I found a yellowish pebble the size of a crab apple and put it in my mouth. Kept going, pushing through the heat. If you were really clever, I thought, you'd go back to Moon Eye's watering place on Salt Creek, wait for him there, catch him by starlight. But you're not clever. You're stupid, I reminded myself. Stick to the plan. I stopped to swab the sweat from my face. The silence locked around me again like a sphere of glass. Even the noise I made unscrewing the cap from the canteen seemed harsh and exaggerated, a gross intrusion. I listened. Something breathing nearby. I was in the presence of a tree. On the slope above stood a giant old juniper with massive twisted trunk, its boughs sprinkled with the pale blue inedible berries. Hanging from one of the limbs was what looked at first glance like a pair of trousers that reached to the ground.
Blinking the sweat out of my eyes, I looked harder and saw the trousers transform themselves into the legs of a large animal. Focused my attention and distinguished through the obscurity of the branches and foliage the outline of a tall horse. A very tall horse. Gently, I lowered my canteen to the ground. I touched the rope and hackamore bunched up inside my shirt. Still there. I took the pebble from my mouth, held it in my palm, and slowly and carefully and quietly stepped toward the tree. Out of the tree, a gleaming eyeball watched me coming. I said, "That you, Moon Eye?" "Who else?" The eyeball rolled. I saw the flash of white. The eye in the tree. I stepped closer.
"What are you doing out here, you old fool?"
The horse stood not under the tree. The juniper was not big enough for that. But within it, among its branches. There'd be an awful smashing and crashing of dry wood if he tried to drive out of there.
"Eh? What do you think you're up to, anyway? Damned old idiot."
I showed him the yellowish stone in my hand, round as a little apple.
"Why don't you answer me, Moon Eye? Forgotten how to talk?"
Moving closer. The horse remained rigid, ears up. I could see both eyes now, the good one and the bad one, moonstruck like a bloodshot cue ball.
"I've come to take you home, old horse. What do you think of that?"
He was a giant, about 17 hands high, with a buckskin hide as faded as an old rug, and a big, ugly, coffin-shaped head.
"You've been out here in the wilderness long enough, old man. It's time to go home."
He looked old, all right. He looked his years. He looked more than old. He looked like a specter. Apocalyptic. A creature out of a bad dream.
"You hear me, Moon Eye? I'm coming closer."
His 19 ribs jutted out like the rack of a skeleton, and his neck, like a camel's, seemed far too gaunt and long to carry that oversized head off the ground.
"You old brute," I murmured. "You hideous old gargoyle. You goddamned nightmare of a horse. Moon Eye, look at this. Look at this in my hand, Moon Eye."
He watched me, watched my eyes. I was within 20 feet of him, and except for the eyes, he had yet to reveal a twitch of nerve or muscle. He might have been petrified, mesmerized by sun and loneliness. He hadn't seen a man for how many years?
"Moon Eye," I said, approaching slowly, one short step, a pause, another step. "How long since you've stuck that ugly face of yours into a bucket of barley and bran? Remember what alfalfa tastes like, old partner? How about grass, Moon Eye? Green, sweet, fresh, succulent grass, Moon Eye. What do you think of that, eh?"
We were about 10 feet apart. Only the branches of the juniper tree separated us. Standing there watching the horse, I could smell the odor of cedar wood, the fragrance of the tree. Another step.
"Moon Eye?"
I hesitated. To get any closer, I'd have to push through the branches or stoop underneath them.
"Come on, Moon Eye. I want to take you home. It's time to go home, old-timer."
We stared at each other, unmoving. If that animal was breathing, I couldn't hear it. The silence seemed absolute. Not a fly, not a single fly, crawled over his arid skin or whined around his roomy eyeballs. If it hadn't been for the light of something like consciousness in his good eye, I might have imagined I was talking to a scarecrow, a dried, stuffed, completely mummified horse. He didn't even smell like a horse. Didn't seem to have any smell about him at all. Perhaps if I reached out and touched him, he would crumble to a cloud of dust.
vanish like a shadow. My head ached from the heat and glare, and for a moment I wondered if this horse-like shape in front of me was anything more than hallucination. "Moon Eye? Keep talking." I couldn't stand there all afternoon. I took another step forward, pressing against a branch. Got to keep talking. "Moon Eye?" He lowered his head a couple of inches, the ears flattened back. Watch out. He was still alive after all. For the first time, I felt a little fear. He was a big horse, and that moon-glazed eye was not comforting. We watched each other intently through the branches of the tree. If I could only wait, only be patient, I might yet sweet-talk him into surrender. But it was too hot. "Look here, old horse. Have a sniff of this." I offered him the pebble with one hand, and with the other unbuttoned a button of my shirt, preparing to ease out the rope when the chance came. "Go on. Have a look." I was within 6 feet of the monster. "Now you just relax, Moon Eye, old boy. I'm coming in where you are now." I started to push through the boughs of the juniper. "Easy, boy. Easy now." He backed violently, jarring the whole tree. Loose twigs and berries rained around us. The good eye glared at me, the bad one shone like a boiled egg. Monocular vision. "Take it easy, old buddy," speaking softly. I had one hand on the rope. I stepped forward again, pushing under the branches. Softly. "Easy, easy. Don't be scared." Moon Eye tried to back again, but his retreat was blocked. Snorting like a truck, he came forward, right at me, bursting through the branches. Dry wood snapped and popped, dust filled the air, and as I dove for the ground, I had a glimpse of a lunatic horse expanding suddenly, growing bigger than all the world and soaring over me on wings that flapped like a bat's and nearly tore the tree out of the earth. When I opened my eyes a second later, I was still alive and Moon Eye was down in the wash 50 feet away, motionless as a statue, waiting. He stood with his ragged broom tail and his right-angled pelvic bones toward me, but had that long neck and coffin head cranked around, watching me with the good eye, waiting to see what I would do next. He didn't intend to exert himself unless he was forced to. The shade of the tree was pleasant, and I made no hurry to get up. I sat against the trunk and checked for broken bones. Everything seemed all right except my hat, a few feet away, crushed into the dirt by a mighty hoof. I was thirsty, though, and looked around for the canteen before remembering where I'd left it. I could see it down in the wash, near the horse. Moon Eye didn't move. He stood rigid as stone, conserving every drop of moisture in his body. But he was in the sun now, and I was in the shade. Perhaps if I waited long enough, he'd be forced to come back to the tree. I made myself comfortable and waited. The silence settled in again. But that horse wouldn't come, though I waited a full hour by the sun. The horse moved only once in all that time, lowering his head for a sniff at a bush near his foreleg. The red cliffs rippled behind the veil of heat, radiant as hot iron. Thirst was getting to me. I stirred myself, got up painfully, and stepped out of the wreckage of the juniper. The horse made no move. "Moon Eye," I said. He listened carefully. "Let's get out of here. What do you say?" "Let's go home, you miserable old bucket of guts." "Okay." I picked up my flattened hat, reformed it, put it on. "Well, what do you say?" I started down the slope. He raised his head, twitched one ear, watching me. "Are you crazy, old horse, standing out here in the heat? Don't you have any sense at all?" I did not approach him directly this time, but moved obliquely across the slope, hoping to head him down the canyon toward the creek and the trail to the corral. Moon Eye saw my purpose and started up the canyon. I hurried. The horse moved faster. I slowed to a walk. He did the same. I stopped, and he stopped.
Moon Eye, let me tell you something. I can outrun you if I have to. These Utah cowboys would laugh themselves sick if I ever mentioned it out loud, but it's a fact, and you ought to know it. Over the long haul, say 20 or 30 miles, it's a known fact that a healthy man can outrun a horse.
Moon Eye listened.
But by God, in this heat, Moon Eye, do you think we should?
Be sensible. Let's not make fools of ourselves. He waited.
I squatted on my heels and passed my forefinger, like a windshield wiper, across my forehead, brushing off the streams of sweat. My head felt hot, damp, feverish.
What's the matter with you, Moon Eye?
The horse kept his good eye on me.
Are you crazy, maybe? You don't want to die out here, do you? All alone like a hermit? In this awful place?
He watched me and listened.
The turkey buzzards will get you, Moon Eye. They'll smell you dying. They'll come flapping down on you like foul and dirty kites and roost on your neck and drink your eyeballs while you're still alive. Yes, they do that. And just before that good eye is punctured, you'll see those black wings shutting off the sky, shutting out the sun. You'll see a crooked yellow beak and a red neck crawling with lice and a pair of insane eyes looking into yours. You won't like that, old horse.
I paused. Moon Eye was listening. He seemed attentive. But I sensed that he wasn't really much interested in what I was saying. Perhaps it was an old story to him. Maybe he didn't care. I continued with the sermon.
And when the buzzards are through with you, Moon Eye, and you'll be glad when that's over, why then a quiet little coyote will come loping down the canyon in the middle of the night under the moon, Moon Eye, nosing out your soul. He'll come to within 50 yards of you, old comrade, and sit for a few hours thinking, and then he'll circle around you a few times trying to smell out the hand of man. Pretty soon his belly will get the best of his caution. Maybe he hasn't eaten for 2 weeks and hasn't had a chance at a dead horse for 2 years. And so he'll come nosing close to you, tongue out and eyes bright with happiness, and all at once, when you're hardly expecting it, he'll pounce and hook his fangs into your scrawny old haunch and tear off a steak. Are you listening to me, Moon Eye? And when he's gorged himself sick, he'll retire for a few hours of peaceful digestion. In the meantime, the ants and beetles and blowflies will go to work, excavating tunnels through your lungs, kidneys, stomach, windpipe, brains and entrails, and whatever else the buzzards and the coyote leave. Moon Eye watched me as I spoke. I watched him. And in a couple of weeks you won't even stink anymore, and after a couple of months there'll be nothing left but your mangled hide and your separated bones, and... get this, Moon Eye, get the picture. Way out in eternity somewhere, on the far side of the sun, they'll hang up a brass plaque with the image of your moon-eyed soul stamped on it. That's about all. Years later, some tired and dirty cowboy looking for a lost horse, some weary prospector looking for potash or beryllium will stumble up this way and come across your clean white ribcage, your immaculate skull, a few other bones. I stopped talking. I was tired. Would that sun never go down beyond the canyon wall? Wasn't there a cloud in the whole state of Utah? The horse stood motionless as a rock. He looked like part of that burnt-out landscape. He looked like the steed of Don Quixote carved out of wood by Giacometti. I could see the blue of the sky between his ribs, through the eye sockets of his skull. Dry, odorless, still and silent, he looked like the idea, without the substance, of a horse. My brain and eyes ached, my limbs felt hollow. I had to breathe deliberately, making a conscious effort. The thought of the long walk back to my saddle pony, the long ride back to the pickup truck, made my heart sink. I didn't want to move. So I'd wait, too, wait for sundown before starting the march home, the Anabasis in retreat. I glanced toward the sun. About 4 o'clock. Another hour before that sun would reach the rim of the canyon. I crawled back to the spotted shade of the juniper and waited. We waited then, the horse and I, enduring the endless afternoon, the heart-breaking heat, and passed the time as best we could in one-sided conversation. I'd speak a sentence and wait about 10 minutes for the next thought and speak again. Moon Eye watched me all the time and made no move. At last the sun touched the skyline, merged with it for a moment in a final explosive blaze of light and heat, and sank out of sight. The shadow of the canyon wall advanced across the canyon floor, included the horse, touched the rocks and brush on the far side. A wave of cooling relief, like a breeze, like an actual movement of air, washed through the canyon. A rock wren sang. A few flies came out of hiding and droned around the juniper tree. I could almost see the leaves of the saltbush and blackbush relax a little, uncurling in the evening air. I stood up and emerged from the shelter of the broken tree. Old Moon Eye took a few steps away from me, stopped, still watching. We faced each other across some 50 feet of sand and rock, no doubt for the last time. I tried to think of something suitable to say, but my mouth was so dry, my tongue so stiff, my lips so dried out and cracked, I could barely utter a word. "You damned stupid har," I croaked, and gave it up. Moon Eye blinked his good eye once, twitched his hide, and kept watching me as all around us, along the wash and on the canyon walls, and in the air, the desert birds and desert bugs resumed their inexplicable careers. A whiptail lizard scurried past my feet. A primrose opened its petals a few inches above the still hot sand. Knees shaking, I stepped toward the horse, pulled the ropey hackamore out of my shirt. To Moon Eye, it must have looked as if I were pulling out my intestines, and threw the thing with all the strength I had left straight at him. It slithered over his back like a hairy snake, scaring him into a few quick steps. Again he stopped, the eye on me. Enough. I turned my back on the horse and went to the canteen, picked it up. The water was almost too hot to drink, but I drank it all, except a few drops which I poured on my fingers and dabbed on my aching forehead. Refusing to look again at the spectre horse, I slung the canteen over my shoulder and started homeward, trudging over the clashing stones and through the sand down canyon toward my pony and Salt Creek. Once, twice, I thought I heard footsteps following me, but when I looked back, I saw nothing. Down the River. The beavers had to go and build another goddamn dam on the Colorado. Not satisfied with the enormous silt trap and evaporation tank called Lake Mead, back of Boulder Dam, they have created another even bigger, even more destructive in Glen Canyon. This reservoir of stagnant water will not irrigate a single square foot of land or supply water for a single village. Its only justification is the generation of cash through electricity for the indirect subsidy of various real estate speculators, cotton growers, and sugar beet magnates in Arizona, Utah, and Colorado. Also, of course, to keep the engineers and managers of the Reclamation Bureau off the streets and out of trouble. The impounded waters form an artificial lake named Powell, supposedly to honor, but actually to dishonor, the memory, spirit, and vision of Major John Wesley Powell, first American to make a systematic exploration of the Colorado River and its environs. Where he and his brave men once lined the rapids and glided through silent canyons 2,000 feet deep, the motorboats now smoke and whine, scumming the water with cigarette butts, beer cans, and oil,
dragging the water skiers on their endless rounds clockwise.
"Play safe," read the official signboards. "Ski only in clockwise direction. Let's all have fun together." With regulations enforced by water cops in government uniforms. Sold. Down the river.
Once it was different there. I know, for I was one of the lucky few, there could have been thousands more, who saw Glen Canyon before it was drowned. In fact, I saw only a part of it, but enough to realize that here was an Eden, a portion of the Earth's original paradise. To grasp the nature of the crime that was committed, imagine the Taj Mahal or Chhatra Cathedral, buried in mud until only the spires remain visible. With this difference, those man-made celebrations of human aspiration could conceivably be reconstructed, while Glen Canyon was a living thing, irreplaceable, which can never be recovered through any human agency. Now, as I write these words, the very same coalition of persons in avarice which destroyed Glen Canyon is preparing a like fate for parts of the Grand Canyon. What follows is the record of a last voyage through a place we knew even then was doomed. One day in late June, Ralph Newcomb and I arrive on the shore of the Colorado River at a site known variously as Height, White Canyon, or Dandy Crossing, about 150 miles upriver from the new dam already under construction. In my pickup truck, badly shaken by a long drive down one of the roughest roads in Utah, we carry camping gear, enough grub for 2 weeks, and two little rubber boats folded up in suitcase-size cartons. We spend half a day on the shore, preparing our boats and ourselves for the journey. The river looks terribly immense and powerful, swollen with snowmelt from the western slope of the Rockies and from the Wind River Range in Wyoming. A veritable Mississippi of a river, rolling between red rock walls. Our rubber boats, after we inflate them, seem gaudy, flimsy, and much too small. Inevitably, we've forgotten a few things, among them life jackets, and I can't help thinking that maybe we should make the trip some other time. One of the things that worries me, besides the missing life jackets and the obvious fragility of our made-in-Japan vessels, is the fact that Ralph has only one good leg. He can walk, but not hike. He can swim, but not very far. However, I keep my cowardly doubts to myself, waiting for Ralph to speak of them first. But he doesn't. Imperturbable as the river itself, tranquil as the sky overhead, he puffs on his corncob pipe, limping back and forth between the truck and the launching point, with canned goods and bedrolls. We divide our supplies, mostly bacon and beans, into equal parts, bind them in canvas and rope, and stow them under the bow seats. In case one boat is lost, we will still have survival rations left in the other. Ralph has also had sense enough to bring along a bit of line and a few fish hooks. The river is lively with catfish, as we'll soon discover. We expect to spend about 10 days on the river, and will not see any human habitation after Height, until we reach the dam site, 150 miles downstream. At last we're ready. I push my boat onto the water of an inlet and climb aboard. The floor of the boat is nothing but a single layer of rubberized canvas and sags like jelly beneath my weight. Sitting there, I can feel the coolness of the water through the canvas and my blue jeans. But it floats, this toy boat, and I can find no more excuses for delay. Since Ralph has a camera and wants pictures of the launching, I'm obliged to go first. I paddle out of the quiet inlet and onto the brown, silt-rich bosom of the Colorado. This is my first experience with a rubber boat, and I discover at once that a single canoe-type paddle is not appropriate. The shallow-drafted, almost weightless boat tends to turn in circles, pivoting beneath my seat. In order to make any headway, I have to shift the paddle quickly from side to side, an awkward and tiring procedure. Staying clear of the main current, drifting slowly past the shore, I paddle in circles and wait for Ralph to catch up. He comes alongside.
We lash the boats together, side by side, which makes not only for better companionship and ease of conversation, but also improves the maneuverability. Ralph paddles on one side, I on the other, giving us some control over our direction. We paddle our double craft into the current, ship paddles, lean back against the stern seats, which make good backrests and nothing much else, and smoke and talk. My anxieties have vanished, and I feel instead a sense of cradle-like security, of achievement and joy, a pleasure almost equivalent to that first entrance, from the outside, into the neck of the womb. We are indeed enjoying a very intimate relation with the river, only a layer of fabric between our bodies and the water. I let my arm dangle over the side and trail my hand in the flow. Something dreamlike and remembered, that sensation called déjà vu. When was I here before? A moment of groping back through the maze, following the thread of a unique emotion, and then I discover the beginning. I am fulfilling at last a dream of childhood, and one as powerful as the erotic dreams of adolescence. Floating down the river. Mark Twain, Major Powell. Every man that has ever put forth on flowing water knows what I mean. A human shout reaches our ears from the west shore. A man is waving at us from the landing of Old Heights Ferry. A warning? A farewell? He shouts once more, but his words are unintelligible. Cheerfully waving back, we drift past him and beyond his ken without the faintest intimation of regret. We shall not see another of the tool-making breed for a long time, and we could not care less. Misanthropy? Shakespeare could say, "Man delights not me, no, nor woman neither." And Raleigh, too. I wish I loved the human race, I wish I loved its silly face. And Jeffers, "Be in nothing so moderate as in love of man." But no, this is not at all what we feel at this moment, not at all what I mean. In these hours and days of dual solitude on the river, we hope to discover something quite different, to renew our affection for ourselves and the humankind in general by a temporary legal separation from the mass. And in what other way is it possible for those not saints? And who wants to be a saint? Are saints human? Cutting the bloody cord, that's what we feel. The delirious exhilaration of independence. A rebirth backward in time and into primeval liberty. Into freedom in the most simple, literal, primitive meaning of the word. The only meaning that really counts. The freedom, for example, to commit murder and get away with it scot-free, with no other burden than the jaunty halo of conscience. I look at my old comrade Newcomb in a new light and feel a wave of love for him. I am not going to kill him, and he, I trust, is not going to kill me. My God, I'm thinking, what incredible shit we put up with most of our lives. The domestic routine, same old wife every night, the stupid and useless and degrading jobs, the insufferable arrogance of elected officials, the crafty cheating and the slimy advertising of the businessmen, the tedious wars in which we kill our buddies instead of our real enemies back home in the capital, the foul, diseased, and hideous cities and towns we live in, the constant petty tyranny of automatic washers and automobiles and TV machines and telephones. Oh, Christ, I'm thinking, at the same time that I'm waving goodbye to that hollering idiot on the shore, what intolerable garbage and what utterly useless crap we bury ourselves in day by day while patiently enduring at the same time the creeping strangulation of the clean white collar and the rich but modest four-in-hand garrote. Such are my—you wouldn't call them thoughts, would you? Such are my feelings, a mixture of revulsion and delight as we float away on the river, leaving behind for a while all that we most heartily and joyfully detest. That's what the first taste of the wild does to a man, after having been too long penned up in the city. No wonder the authorities are so anxious to smother the wilderness under asphalt and reservoirs. They know what they're doing. Their lives depend on it, and all their rotten institutions. Play safe. Ski only in clockwise direction. Let's all have fun together. We drift on. The current seems to accelerate a bit as the mighty river squeezes between great red walls of sandstone rising on either side to heights of 1,000 feet or more, cliffs so sheer and smooth even a bird could find no perch there. One little white cloud of dubious substantiality hovers above in the strip of blue between the canyon walls. Gazing up at it, I think I hear, as in a dream, a confused rumble and roar, the sound of a freight train highballing down a mountain grade. Rapids. Actually, there are not supposed to be true rapids in Glen Canyon, only riffles. But it's been a dry winter, the river is low, the rocks high. To us, these foamy waves look like rapids. White water ahead, says Ralph quietly, with a sort of complacent satisfaction, as if he had invented the phenomenon all by himself. And instead of doing anything about it, he reloads his cheap pipe. We are rounding the first major bend in the canyon. From ahead comes the sound of the rapids, toneless vibrations growing stronger, what acoustical specialists call white noise. Like the sound of a waterfall. Supposedly a blissful and sleep-inducing impression on edgy nerves. I didn't know we'd hit rapids so soon, I say to Ralph. I open up my map, the only one we've brought with us, a Texaco road map of the state of Utah, and study the tributaries of the Colorado. That must be where Trachyte Creek comes in, I explain. If we had life jackets with us, it might be a good idea to put them on now. Actually, our ignorance and carelessness are more deliberate than accidental. We are entering Glen Canyon without having learned much about it beforehand because we wish to see it as Powell and his party had seen it, not knowing what to expect, making anew the discoveries of others. If the first rapids are a surprise to us, it is simply because we had never inquired if there were any on this stretch of the river. Anyway, there's no turning back now. After the entrance, the inescapable spasm. Between narrowing walls, the river rushes at increasing speed. Our little boats bounce over choppy waves toward the whitecaps that now are visible, churning to foam around glistening wet boulders strewn across our course, boulders which seem to rise and fall as we race toward them on the bounding current. There is no longer time enough to be frightened. I have a glimpse